versus, I mean, Donnell versus Laura, which was 2,250-1. That 703 Southwest 2nd, 257 San Antonio court. This court recognized that jury verdict in Beacon National versus Reynolds, 799 Southwest 2nd, 390. In that case, this court held that 28-1 was not excessive. I think it's important to realize that 13 people have reviewed the evidence so far before the judge. It is 12 people on the jury, a Parker County jury, a conservative jury, which is comprised of two people from consumer or from customer relations, a 21-year veteran of the Fulton Police Department, two teachers. One was the foreman of the jury, and another was a teacher at the independent school district there in Parker County. There was a professor from Dallas Baptist University that teaches history. Her husband's a preacher. All this in voir dire shows that this was a well-educated jury that was considering the evidence.
So what if they were giving the wrong charge? How do you think the question
15 is comprised of two parts. Are you talking about the fraud, the gross negligence?
Yes.
The history of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code was changed in 2003. Prior to that, it was only malice, fraud, or the intentional infliction of the bodily injury. The malice definition in 2003 was separated out to malice and gross negligence. The underlying or previous question had both definitions, the intentional infliction or the subjective objective test of gross negligence as it is now. Certainly in cases past, someone can submit any one of the underlying four theories, along with malice, whether it be the gross negligence definition or standard, or the malice standard as it is now, and recover the damages. Just because they are a separate question now does not mean that they have to match up. The gross negligence, fraud, and malice under Chapter 31 only relates to the minimal culpability of the actor. And in this case, Lynn Strickland had the mental culpability of gross negligence. I would say he also had the mental culpability of fraud and malice. However, the only one that was suggested in court or given to the jury was gross negligence. The only requirement is there must be an underlying tort with harm. It does not say, none of the cases say that you have to have an underlying tort of negligence in order to recover gross negligence. It only goes to what was the mental culpability, reckless disregard for the harm. And in taking her money or in representing, making misrepresentations, Lynn Strickland did not hear what the harm may have been. I don't know if it raises to the malice that he intended for her to rely on everything he may have aimed at the time without knowing that he was going to steal a 75. But at some point, he made representations that were false, and he did not care about the results. And it's the mental culpability that will get you to the gross negligence question.
Well, I don't think negligence would have mental culpability. So how would you get the gross negligence if you just had a straight negligence?
Well, you would not. That's why you require an underlying tort, and in order to get the gross negligence, then you look at the mental culpability.
What I'm saying is, every case I've ever had, you had negligence and then gross negligence. But you said to get the gross negligence, you have to have the mental culpability element, and I'm saying in a negligence, gross negligence situation, negligence doesn't have that requirement. As I would understand negligence.
The underlying tort, all the requirement is to get an underlying tort. In your example, you have an underlying tort of negligence.
Okay.
Once you have that and there's harm, the question is, do you find by clear and convincing evidence that the harm to Sheila Newman resulted from gross negligence? All it is asking is, was the harm the result of gross negligence? Gross negligence is the mental culpability of the actor when he did the act. It would be the same if it was.
Okay. I guess I misunderstood it.
And you keep talking about the mental culpability, Mr. Strickland.
Correct. Question 15 is a two-part question. First part, in order for Lynn Strickland to be, or in order for us, or Sheila Newman to get to gross negligence, we have to show that the acts or the harm resulted from a mental culpability of the actor. Once you achieve the gross negligence of that, Then the second part of the question, is that gross negligence attributable to National Western? At that point, that's when the jury is further instructed that National Western may be gross negligent because of an act by Lynn Strickland, but only if they authorized to do in a manner when Strickland was unfit and National Western or vice principal ratified the conduct. Clearly, 12 jurors unanimously found that this is what happened. The court then subsequently reviewed all the evidence as required and as National Western requested to determine that it was not only not excessive, but it was due process. And the court determined that it did and entered judgment. I'd also like to say, although the numbers do sound big, it's important to put it into perspective. To this company, worth $1.1 billion, it's difficult for anyone to grasp that amount of money. But $150,000 of them would be the equivalent of, if you take an individual worth $100,000, if you take an individual worth $100,000, these damages would only be about $10.18 for that individual. Or 15% of his net worth would be $15,000. $15,000 would not be grossly excessive for an individual worth $100,000. It would sting. It would hurt. It would certainly punish them, which was the goal.
Thank you, Mr. Lavin. Mr. Watson. The court has been very perceptive. I'll go straight to your questions, if I may. First, Justice McCoy, there is an obvious attempt here to moor a liability finding neither pleaded, proven, nor requested, in which is direct liability. That is, this court has held that negligent misrepresentation is a direct liability cause of action. It's not based on respondeat superior. It's not based on control. It's something we did. That's what they're trying to do, is morph that somehow into responsibility for this individual's fraud. What this case ultimately comes down to, each of you in your own way, is put your finger on it, to hold National Western responsible either in for liability for actual damages or punitive damages, you're going to have to come to this conclusion. National Western, under the law as we know it today, actually authorized or apparently authorized this man to defraud National Western. And the cases are replete in holding that that is patently absurd. It flies in the face of every concept there is of what authority means or what apparent authority means. And the problem with doing what they're doing, of trying to make this now sort of about negligent entrustment because of these alleged prior bad acts, is that if you will look at Fort Worth elevators, it makes it crystal clear what has to be proven to get there. Let me show you what was proven there. Walker's gross negligence caused the death. Pettyjohn, the company man, gross negligence in keeping Walker employed by the company. He was grossly negligent. Pettyjohn was a vice principal. It was an act of the company in doing it. But what does the court go on to say? However, we are of the opinion that the plaintiff in error was entitled on the front end, on the negligent representation part, to have its common law defenses, approximate cause, sole proximate cause, fellow servant, assumed risk presented to the jury. The way this was done, we didn't get to defend negligent misrepresentation, which is the real way this case was tried. We were denied that. Categorically not. This was a case in which they had the opportunity to plead, prove, and obtain the findings necessary to support a judgment. They failed on all counts. We are entitled to rendition because the findings of the jury will not support a judgment.
Just answer the question I was going to ask.
I have one more question to answer, Your Honor. Do you want me to stop or go on?
No, I believe
you have 2 minutes. Oh, 2 minutes. I thought the jig was up. Thank you, Your Honor. Second, I would like you to focus on the issue of the whole authority thing on Bennett versus Reynolds. That court was very careful to say what the damaging act was. It wasn't rounding up the cattle. It wasn't putting the cattle in the trailer. The court made it crystal clear that the damaging, the only act for which there could be punishment, was the act of, rather than taking the cattle back to Reynolds, was converting them by taking them to the slaughterhouse and putting the check into the bank. That is the damaging act. And that follows through to Farlow, this court's opinion, where the parties allege that they sent the doctor to us, just like they sent him to our home. This court said it doesn't matter. He's an independent contractor. Sending him to you didn't authorize and didn't apparently authorize the damaging act. And Rio Grande Insurance, cited in the brief, was a general agent case, a general agent, not a soliciting agent case. And the court in that case said, I'm sorry, general agent is not authority to commit fraud. It simply is not authority to commit fraud. It goes so far outside the bounds of agency that it is not authorized. That's the second point that goes away. On punitive damages, all I can say there is that we clearly stand on what we said. Wealth is not a substitute for the factors that warrant punitive damages, and we did not get a chance to have our culpability, the party to be charged, to be punished, assessed for the factors that must be assessed. We are not Strickland. And because we are not Strickland, and there was, they had every opportunity to submit this thing in a way that might get there, but the evidence in this record won't support getting there on liability or punitive damages. That's the reason it must be reversed and rendered. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate all counsel being here with us today at TWU. We appreciate your argument being a briefing, and it's all very nice to have. You all are free.
Thank you.
Okay, Lawrence, what's your say?
May it please the court, Mr. Nick Davis to argue for appellant and Ms. Tanya Dahoney to argue for the state.
May it please the court, counsel. First off, on behalf of my client and myself, I'd like to thank the court for the opportunity to argue here today at Texas Wesleyan. And I'd also like to illustrate two reasons why oral arguments are important in this particular case. The first is to frame the issue. That was my original point when I submitted the brief, and that is because this is a reasonable suspicion analysis here, and it's based on a DWI arrest. And the analysis was whether or not there was a detention with reasonable suspicion, or was that detention actually a consensual encounter. And either way, the issue is, did the court err in granting a 3823 jury instruction, which was requested during the trial? The court based their legal finding on a factual set, a disputed factual set, that was that the encounter between the arresting officer and the defendant, Mr. Morris in this case, was consensual. In other words, in the findings of fact, the judge said, or the court ruled that that was a consensual encounter. If I may just give the backdrop and distinguishing facts about this analysis that sets this case apart from some of the typical cases that are usually cited on a reasonable suspicion analysis. The first is that it is important for the court to keep in consideration that this detention or encounter or arrest occurred at a residence, so it was not on the roadside. The second is that there were no people, including the arresting officer or the detaining officer, that actually, what we call, wheeled the defendant. Nobody saw any driving by the person that was arrested.
How about the first officer on the scene who identified the appellant and I thought he saw
the guy who was driving the car. No, Your Honor. The records would show that the officer showed up and merely observed the 911 caller pointing to a residence where there was a white male standing 10 feet from the vehicle that was described in the 911 call. The second reason why oral arguments are important here is because obviously both briefs cite Derek's Wheeler, if I may. When my brief was submitted and when this case was tried, the opinion out of the Second Court of Appeals, Derek's Wheeler, was the law that was controlling. And subsequently, the Criminal Court of Appeals issued a reversal on some issues on that case. And then the state submitted their reply brief. And so this would be my first opportunity to explain why the ruling from the Criminal Court of Appeals doesn't take my legs out from under me, if I will, on this appeal. If I could just go through some of the facts that are actually not in dispute during this case, and that is at 3 a.m. in Arlington, dispatch received a call from a named complainant, Mr. Beavers, describing erratic, reckless driving by a white work truck. He went on to give speeding and failure to change lanes, and gave the license plate of the truck. Beavers followed the truck to the residence and described that he could make out a white male who exited the truck. Beavers testified at trial, though, that he did, in fact, take his eyes off of the white male during the time that he was sitting there observing this until the officer showed up. And when the officer showed up, the first to respond, the arresting officer, was Officer Lanfield. And in my brief, I point out that he did not corroborate his information, and the Dirks Miller case would say that that's no longer as important. But he didn't corroborate. What he saw was he had a call text that explained that it was a DWI complainant following, and he saw the complainant pointing to a residence. At that time, he made the decision to pull into the driveway with lights on, and blocking, it's important that he pulled into the driveway, blocking the white vehicle's ingress and egress from where it was at. Now, let me be very clear.
Your client wasn't in the car, so that becomes sort of non-sequitur.
Well, I think it's important in when we get to the analysis of what this is detention, which the trial court said that it was not. I think it's important because what were Mr. Morris's or a reasonable person's options at the time that an officer pulls into your driveway with lights on and says, come here. Your options are to either get in your car or go in your house, both of which I submit would not be reasonable, and therefore that would be a detention. But getting back, I said that the lights were on. I want to be perfectly clear. The record is incomplete on this issue. There is testimony by Officer Lanfield that says that my client, Mr. Morris, was very upset because of the scene of there being a police car in his driveway with the lights on. I would argue that that suggests that it's not just the headlights that are making him upset, it's the actual scene of there being emergency lights. There is also testimony that says that he was upset later on by Officer Lanfield that says he was upset because Officer Lanfield had Mr. Moore sitting in a fashion where the headlights were in his eyes. I want to be very clear on that, not to mislead the court on the fact that there were lights on. Obviously, if there are lights on, that makes my case for there being a detention all that much more stronger. And so that gets me to, from there, the...
I'm not following you with the lights on and the fact that the police from there and a police car, what difference does it make if the lights are on or not?
The emergency...
The lights aren't going to make them sit down or not. The police car is not going to make them sit down or not. The police officer is going to make them sit down or not. So it seems to me we have to focus on what the police officer did. I mean, he could have driven up in an unmarked car. But if it's a police officer in uniform telling him what to do, it seems to me that's the focus of what we're going to be concerned about.
And that was the focus of my argument at trial and the focus of my brief.
Okay.
It is just an outlying factor in determining whether or not a reasonable, or whether or not this was a detention. Because there is case law that says that determining whether or not a police officer's emergency lights are on are a factor in determining that that would be a detention. And that would be a slip opinion, a memorandum opinion of Sosa v. State. I can have the site for you later. And that would just go to saying that this was a detention. But the issue is, what was the officer's actions? And that's what my brief focused on. And that was what was in dispute, which brings me to my argument. And that is that the trial court made a factual finding that was in dispute. And that factual dispute was, how did this conversation take place? In other words, how did the contact between the arresting officer and the defendant take place? State v. Madden lays out the test on whether or not a 3823 jury instruction should be granted. And the test is, there must be affirmatively contested evidence. In other words, there has to be a factual dispute, and it has to be affirmatively contested. Madden goes so far as to say it cannot be mere insinuations by the defense attorney. In this case, we had a factual dispute on how the encounter between a police officer and Mr. Morris occurred. In the record, and on direct, when Officer Lanfield testified, during Lanfield's testimony, and not my questions during the trial, he said, well, I asked Mr. Morris to come over to me and speak with me. That is in conflict with, right before that, on direct, he said, I approached Mr. Morris on the lawn. Now, the state says in their brief, that these two are not mutually exclusive. I would say that it would not make sense for an officer to walk up to somebody and then ask them to approach them.
Approach doesn't necessarily mean walked up to. It just means walk in their direction. I walked in your direction and I said, you come the rest of the way.
The important part is that the officer did say he approached Mr. Morris in his lawn, which would indicate that he pulled into the driveway and walked up to Mr. Morris. That action versus him pulling in the driveway and giving Mr. Morris a command and asking him to come forward, that would be similar to, and that affects Mr. Morris's reasonable belief on whether or not he's free to leave. In other words, the test on whether or not this is a detention. There's a Band of the State, 890 Southwest 2nd, 42, cited in my brief, where an officer pulled into a driveway, walks up to a party. And this officer had seen some driving, but this officer says, would the driver of this vehicle please come to me? And I say that these two scenarios are somewhat similar, except the distinguishing factor and the most important factor on that scenario is that this is not a crowd where Mr. Morris is. In the Bandit case, there was a crowd, and that goes to the reasonableness of an individual feeling that they were not free to leave. In other words, if I'm in a crowd, could I rely on somebody else stepping forward? As if I'm standing by myself, an officer gives me a request, how reasonable is it for me to ignore his request and go about my business? That's the first affirmatively contested testimony by Officer Lindsay. But there is more. He went on to testify indirect that he said he had a conversation with Morris. And during that conversation, he did find out that Morris was, in fact, the driver of the white vehicle. But at the end of that conversation, Lanfield described that he actually had him sit down, cross his legs, and wait. And essentially what he's saying is he did not detain Morris until after the conversation. But that is in contradiction to what he says on redirect. After I cross-examined him and asked him, was this reasonable, or was this detention reasonable, the state redirected and said, Officer Lanfield, what happened when you showed up? And Officer Lanfield said, I arrived at 0300, I detained the defendant, and I kept him detained for only 19 minutes until Officer Walker came in. And in that context, they were saying that the length of the detention was reasonable. But that also shows that the officer is admitting that upon his initial arrival, his pulling into the driveway was a detention. Those two are different fact sets laid out by the officer. state is arguing that this is not a material fact dispute. In other words, if the trial court can get to reasonable suspicion or they're not needing to be reasonable suspicion, which was what happened in this trial court's opinion, then that it would not be material. If it's not dispositive, it would not be material. We'd argue that in doing a analysis on determining whether or not this is a detention or a consensual encounter, you must determine what Justice McCoy said, and that is the interaction, what the officer's response or requests were. And so that is material because of that dispute. I'll go over the Darius Wheeler. The reason why that is not, that doesn't cut my appeal off on this issue is because that appeal or that case dealt with reasonable suspicion analysis. Now, the state would say that this is not a reasonable suspicion analysis. I, of course, am arguing that this was a detention and it should be. However, it still doesn't follow that the Darius Wheeler case throws me out. And the reason for that is the reasonable suspicion analysis that is required in this case is different and distinguishable from the reasonable suspicion analysis done in a Darius Wheeler case. The officers that made the detention, whether or not they had an offense conveyed to them in a 911 call or not, those officers saw the individual driving. They had the reasonable suspicion on a particular person. And that's the difference, is that the reasonable suspicion must be required, but it also must be established on a particular person. That's the difference in this case. There was not a particular person. The evidence was there was a white male who seemed to have gotten out of the white truck. And that's the difference between the Darius Wheeler case and this case.
Why isn't that a particular person? Since the eyewitness followed behind the vehicle, and not only did that, but then followed the vehicle into the neighborhood, presumably, but the residential. Isn't that a particular person? The idea of being some of the officers.
Well, he pointed to a residence where there was a man standing next to a car. At the time, the officer didn't know that anything else besides that there was a man standing next to a car when he made the detention.
But what the case says is the cumulative knowledge of the 911 dispatcher and the person who followed and the officer, you take all that cumulatively, and then you meet the standard.
I still go back to that not being enough reasonable suspicion to detain on a particular person.
Even though he saw him get out of the car and pointed at him and when the officer got there.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Davis.
And
I think that flattery is a high form of talking or intentional high form of flattery, right? To say, this is a case of leave it to be imitating someone's style of opinion. There was an answer to the case who brought us in the case. And in this situation, as you've seen from the team jillion cases that I've been before you, or that I'm assigned to, we had 911 callers. Now, with the advent that everyone in the world has a cell phone, they are part of our people's technology. In this case, we really don't need to get too bogged down in the FAFSA. This comes out of Judge Mitchell's court. Judge Mitchell does a really nice job of drafting his own backing decisions as well, which we have in this case, and it's been partially by the record. And we don't have to get bogged down into approaches unless you find that what the record shows and what Judge Mitchell wrote are incongruous. They're not that. We don't have to get bogged down in essential kind of that. There's a couple appellate things that we do need to think about. Judge Mitchell is entitled to deference with his findings of fact. So this court looks at those fact findings and applies the law de novo to what happens below. There's a really important standard. It's cited in Dirschweiler, the case that we both, of course, talk about and we both relied on in different ways. That standard started out years ago in Romero from the Court of Appeal, and of course, when we were reviewing on appeal the trial court's decision, very much under the Hank Bear rule, we can affirm the judge's decision on any reason that upholds the decision. But you can't go back and reverse the judge's decision on things that aren't contemplated. Just preservation rules and Hank Bear, and wrapped up in Romero, and I think that this court had a safety Mulder not too long ago. I think Justice Livingston offered that. And actually, what's interesting is the majority opinion and then the one vote dissent both reside that Romero standard because you can't go back and hurt a judge's ruling or undermine it on something new, but you can always think of other reasons that were against the court that might not have even been contemplated. Now, in this trial court, was the reasonable suspicion argument contemplated? No, it wasn't. There's a debate at the trial court about whether or not this was impounded. And the other appellate standard that perhaps we ought to think about is one that always causes me fear when I'm arguing in Austin because I'm going to look at the opinion at that point and see if there's some new opinion that's going to cut my legs out from underneath before I argue that point. But in this situation, the Dirschweiler case came down. That case was actually pending, and PR was granted last May. And so it was still pending on appeal. Standard is, and it's been put out in multiple opinions, also cited by this court, that parties before the courts and the courts of appeals should proceed with caution when relying on non-final opinions. Now, Mr. Davis has done a nice job here. I'm actually doing the same thing too, that because quite frankly, Dirschweiler is still pending at the Court of Criminal Appeals. I checked the website again this morning. The opinion was issued on the 26th of January. Of course, it is a 7-1-1 opinion from the Court of Criminal Appeals, not a case that from the Court of Appeals that we aren't even granted 5 months before the brief was filed. But it looks closer to final. So in proceeding with caution, I'm hoping that I'm showing prudence, but it is not yet final. And technically, cases that are not yet final are not always part of the jurisprudence, as Mr. Davis has found out with the underlying Dirschweiler opinion. So another appellate standard we ought to look at. This case of the Cockat Sawyer is my favorite. It's 727 Southwest 280. It's the Court of Appeals from 1987, and it relies on the Mr. Kamurki case that was one of the first to say that. So a couple of appellate kind of housekeeping things apply. Again, deferring to the facts that we have below, and again, there's wonderful, thorough fact-finding and conclusions of law by Judge Mitchell, and they show that according to Mr. Beavers, he followed someone who likely didn't kill someone. He's traveling over 100 miles an hour on the highway, going east from apparently from this area toward Arlington, almost plowed into the back of Cape, and I've seen many of my other cases that were not so lucky. Swerved to not plow the back of someone, almost to the retaining wall, ultimately exited the field of road. Fishtailing, if it wasn't an important and scary and dangerous fact, you might hear someone go, I remember when I had my first beer or something like that. But this is horrendous driving. And driving the car, hopped out and was in the front seat. And while it was earlier said that nobody wheeled the defendant, Mr. Beavers testified in this trial. He saw the defendant. And of course, the defendant said, we have to wheel him down. It's mailed. There's a cop on that issue. And whether or not reasonable suspicion as to a particular person, well, if you can't see the person in the car, what are we going to do about these cars that have tinted windows? Or what if this car was a huge truck and poor Mr. Beavers was in one of those smart cars that Judge Womack drives? You know, you look at someone who couldn't see the driver. But if that person followed them all the way home, saw one person on the white male standing on the front lawn at this house next to the car that had just been exited, Mr. Beavers was still on his cell phone with the dispatcher. I believe that the call sheet showed three different instances over about 9 minutes where he was talking to the dispatcher saying, yes, the white male's still out there. And it's alive. Lo and behold, there was the person who was still on his phone. But in the lower court, they only debated consensual encounters. But we know from appellate cases in the past that often more than one legal reason upholds an officer's conduct. And y'all probably laugh and keep count of how many times I can rely on some of my old cases. Makes me think of safety clients that this court has, where there was a consensual encounter, and the court said not only was it a consensual encounter, but it was also reasonable suspicion. That's the appeal out of court A. So there were two reasons to uphold the contact that the officer had with the citizen that was arrested in the defendant. Here, we have two reasons. And because one of those reasons does not have what calling for argument's sake, if it's just a fact, the reasonable suspicion rule, then the third prong of Madden, Judge Thompson, how to figure out whether or not you need a 3823 instruction, then December of 2007 tells us that this case is not an instruction, which was the legal issue presented here. And since the instruction was denied below, the trial court was correct in doing that, even though there's no contemplation. In this case, George Ballard just solved the issue. Unless there's any questions, as far as George Ballard or Matt,
I'm not perceiving what you're saying is that there was a consensual encounter, and if there wasn't, and there was contention, there was reasonable suspicion in either case of an instruction.
That's right, Your Honor.
One sentence.
You do it much more concisely than I do. Thank you, Mr.
Homey.
Mr. Davis, rebuttal.
Thank you, Mayor, please report. Just a couple issues that were brought up. First is that the reasonable suspicion argument wasn't contemplated at court. I'd ask the court to remember that there was a motion to suppress based on reasonable suspicion to obtain probable cause to arrest filed before this trial was brought. The decision was to run that motion to suppress during the trial. And if you reflect in the record, the judge even corrected the assistant district attorney at one point, asking the scope of the motion. And the judge said the scope of the motion will determine the legality of the detention. So that argument, I think, was addressed at the trial court. And another issue is that going back to whether or not the car being blocked in was an issue, I took that from Garcia Cantu, and where the court acknowledged, and which was cited in Dirksworthy, which acknowledged that the act of a police car blocking in a vehicle is a very heavy factor in determining whether or not there was detention involved. And my final remark, my request for the court to consider is 3613 Code of Criminal Procedure that requires that all issues of fact are the domain of the jury. And we had a disputed fact. It was material in determining whether or not this was a detention or whether or not it was an encounter or whether or not there was reasonable suspicion. Either way you want to go, it's still material because you have to determine how the conversation took place. And that would have been
what is the fact issue of reasonable suspicion if we follow Gershweiler or however you say that case?
The fact issue was that this case is distinguishable from Gershweiler because that case did not address the particular reasonable suspicion on a particular person.
That's hardly the lead dog argument. I mean, are you just hanging your hat on the fact that there was a person standing there and somebody took their eyes off of it momentarily? I mean, well, I really wasn't following you. Honestly, your argument earlier about why that dog didn't hunt.
Well, I mean, the Dirksworthy case does take a little bit out of the argument there in that they said the cumulative knowledge of the law enforcement.
Right.
And in trial, a lot of this went to whether or not what the analysis was, what did the officer know at the time of the detention? And so that was a lot of the focus on that. But as the state would point out, the issue here is whether or not it's a detention or a consensual encounter. And so frankly, Dirksweiler, while informative, really isn't relevant when determining whether or not this judge or the trial court made a decision and should have given it to the jury, because the issue was, if I may wrap this up, the issue was whether or not it was a detention or an encounter. And so reasonable suspicion would not come into play as far as whether or not it's a detention or an encounter.
And you know that Dirksweiler doesn't just come up with this cumulative language on its own to cite previous cases. So even if this case is turned around, obviously there's other cases that support the same purpose. Footnote 32, according to the opinion, writes a 1987 criminal sex penalty case and a United States Supreme Court case.
Okay. I would stand on the brief and ask that the case be remanded.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. David. Thank you, Mr. Honey. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. Your case is submitted. And you all are now excused and we will adjourn court. Amy, thank you for having us here today at PWD. It's always our pleasure.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.